Hello, curling fans, and welcome back to Way Inside. John Cullen with you as always, and let's talk a little news. I know Warren and Kevin are usually the newsmakers and newsbreakers on this feed, but some big news out of the curling world in the last couple weeks as Reed Carruthers is teaming up with Brad Jacobs for three slams. Maybe a wild card spot too. That seems to be up in the air. If Reed doesn't win Manitoba, Brad doesn't win Northern Ontario, will he be allowed to play at the Brier as a wild card? Who knows? I don't think so, but maybe. Stranger things have happened. And so I think a lot of people saw this and they thought, my goodness, this is crazy. You know, Jason Gunnlaugsson leaves Team Carruthers. Brad Jacobs is in. They're bringing in a big skip. It's a big change. This is... we've never seen this before. Well, you're wrong. We've seen this lots of times before. It is time to step into the way inside, way back machine. Did you know that in the last two seasons alone, there have been seven lineup changes between the start of the season and the Brier? That's right. It's time for a little history lesson, way inside style. In 2022, we had, of course, the famous botcher blow-up that led to Darren Moulding leaving and playing with James Grattan in New Brunswick and Pat Jansen coming in and playing third for Brendan Botcher. Now, in Manitoba, Colin Hodgson, he played the Manitoba Provincial Playdowns on one leg. They won, but unfortunately he wasn't able to play in the Brier. So Team McEwen had to bring in Colton Lott. He filled in admirably at lead. Glenn Howard, he played in the Brier, but you may remember he was injured. He couldn't play in the Ontario Provincial Playdowns, and his son Scott took over skipping duties. They brought in super spare Adam Spencer, and they played as a foursome. And then by the time the Brier rolled around, Glenn was fine. So last year, four changes alone. Oh, and we can't forget, Team Gujou won the Brier with three, with not their original lineup. Mark Nichols had COVID and he was out. How about 2021? It couldn't have been that chaotic, right? Wrong again. Once again, it starts out east as James Grattan's third, Paul Dobson, didn't want to play due to COVID travel restrictions. So John Buick came over from Ontario and filled in at third. They even started 4-1. Looked pretty good for a while there. The Maritime mix-up didn't end there as Jamie Murphy's team was selected to go to the Brier. Remember Omicron? So they just picked Jamie Murphy's team, but Jamie Murphy, same thing. COVID travel restrictions, he didn't want to play, so they bring in Scott McDonald. And as had happened in 2022, in 2021, Glenn Howard also injured. So who filled in? You may remember Wayne Madaw. So now they did great. They went 7-1. They lost the last game of the championship pool against Kevin Cooey. Otherwise, they would have been in a four-way tie at 9-3. They would have made the playoffs. It was a crazy run. So that might be the blueprint for Reed Carruthers, bringing back a skip to play on the team, take over the team. Now, I think Wayne Madaw probably had a few more Caesars in his time off than Brad Jacobs did. But I do think that there is a lot more precedent for this type of thing than we think. And strangely enough, of all the teams that Carruthers and Jacobs might be trying to emulate at the Brier, it was Brendan Botcher who had the most success bringing Pat Jansen on. They made the 1-2 game. They lost that, and they also lost the semifinal to the aforementioned Team Gujou with three players, but they still won a Brier bronze medal despite not only changing their lineup between playdowns and the Brier, but also having to go through all of that controversy swirling around them with the whole Darren Moulding thing. So, Team Carruthers, now with Brad Jacobs, you might think they're screwed, they're done, but they're not. There's a lot of precedent for this, and I know I, for one, will be looking forward to seeing it. Now, speaking of mix-ups, we're going to be interviewing a skip this week whose team did get a little bit mixed up coming into this season, but with a lot of familiar faces returning. I'm going to be talking to John Epping this week, who is now back reunited with Pat Jansen, who came back over from that Team Brendan Botcher team at second. Matt Cam has moved up from the front end to play third, and they've picked up Scott Chadwick, who was on Team Horgan last year that went to the Olympic trials. John and I have a great chat. I don't want to belabor the point anymore. He's getting ready for the Ontario Provincial Playdowns. So let's get to it. This is Way Inside, Episode 3. Here we are with John Epping, Episode number 3. And John, we're going to start the show the same way we always do, with a lightning round right off the top. It's called The Top 4. You're just going to give me a quick answer to these four questions. You ready?
Yeah, as ready as I'm ever going to be, I guess. No warning.
Question one, which curler have you never played with that you would most want to?
It has to be the Koo Dog.
The Koo Dog. Okay. If all the rocks are exactly the same, so you know that both sets are perfect, which color are you picking?
I'm going to go with black.
What's something that's considered a basic thing in curling that you struggled to learn?
I think that you had to hit rocks and take rocks out.
How would your bitterest rival describe you?
I'm kind of like a bad rash. I don't go away.
So they're sort of complimenting you, but they're also pissed off that you just won't leave them alone.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think I've really ticked anybody off in my career. I guess I could have.
I mean, we'll see. I didn't talk to that many people before this interview, but maybe I didn't talk to the right people.
there was a time that, when the whole broom fiasco went down, that we had that magical broom head one time, and I think there were probably a couple guys that were mad at me that day.
I think there were a few people mad at a few people on that day. Yeah.
Relationships were broken.
I like this interview so far. You've just told me all my questions are fantastic, so I'd love to keep that rolling. And this is the first non-lightning round question. Do you like being named John?
Yeah, it's fine. It's pretty basic, but I mean,
right?
But yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
That's how I feel too. It's like fine, but is yours a family thing? Mine's a family thing.
Yeah, family thing. Yeah. And I noticed you're J-O-H-N. So, nobody should call you Jonathan, but some people will call you Jonathan.
Doesn't that piss you off? That drives me nuts when someone calls me Jonathan.
Well, I don't think I have the same anger as you, but it's cool. Because imagine if you get a name that's just, people talk about and they don't like, then you name that. So John, it's not like really anybody can say anything.
That's true. Yeah, mine is I'm the fifth. I'm John the fifth. I have the same first and middle name as my, like, up to my great-great-grandfather.
Oh, that's so there's a bunch of Johns there. And do you have time if I tell you a quick story about the other John Epping?
Yes. Okay. I was going to bring that up. The guy who does like soundscape music.
Well, no, this would be my Uncle John, who is Uncle John.
Oh, Uncle John. Okay. Yeah. Let's go with Uncle John first.
Who's a curler. I know him as Jay, and everybody calls him Jay, but at the Tam Heather Curling Club, everybody calls him, John Epping. And, they say that he's got the name, but he doesn't have the game. So he actually has one of our team jerseys, and on the back, it says double zeros with the name. And another great story when Calcuttas were big, he was at a fun spiel in Scarborough called the Beer and Beef, and Calcutta was up, and this team sees John Epping on the board, and this team is just betting like crazy on John Epping. Goes boom. So number one, I think they go for like a few thousand dollars, and they think it's me. And of course, they're like, John Epping, come on up and meet the team that's bought you. And up walks my uncle. And of course, they're like, you're not John. And then, he pulls out his ID. He's like, well, I am. And anyways, it's classic. So
did he have to, did he give his old nephew a call? Be like, look, you got to bail me out. These guys are threatening to lead pipe me in the parking lot.
I don't think he was in the spiel long enough. So.
Well, I was Googling you, and there is also a John Epping that makes like Brian Eno-esque, like atmospheric soundscape music.
Yes.
And I didn't know if that was secretly you, because there's no pictures of this guy anywhere. So I was like,
you think I would be that cool? No, I am not that cool.
No, I don't. But I just
let's be real.
On my Substack, I wrote an article about the all-time first name teams for men and women. So like if you had to make a team throughout history of all the same, you know, the players all had to have the same first name, right? Who would be the best team? And so I had the Johns in the top three, but unfortunately I did have us, well, not us, I'm not on the team, obviously, but I had us third behind the Kevins and the Davids.
Oh.
But on the John team, I'll say this, I think all the other positions are pretty normal. We've got John, or like pretty obvious. We've got John Landsteiner at lead. We got John Kawaja or John Mead at second. We've got John Morris at third. But the question is, John Epping, who skips, you or Schuster?
Oh, geez, that's a great one. I've seen some video of him sweeping from years back at the Olympics, like when he was at his first one. He should probably skip. Yeah, I watched that. So
you're on the bench.
I think I'm the fifth. I'll just chip. Yeah. Fifth is a great position. What goes in those, in those Tim Hortons cups are fantastic, right?
Oh, baby. I love it. I know I'm about, when this episode drops, I will be the fifth, fifth at BC Provincials. And it's kind of like my dream has always come true. I keep telling people I'd be a great fifth. And now I'm finally getting my chance.
About to find out.
It feels great. Okay, let's talk about your career for Sirius. I wanted to start by rewinding a little bit because I haven't talked to you since 2016 for an interview. So we're almost 7 years since we've talked for an interview, which is, you know, sort of disgraceful. And I asked you a question. I said, what was something that you incorrectly believed was true for a long time, stupidly? And you had an answer to that question that I won't say on this podcast, but it was very funny. But then you had a second answer, which was that you believed that you would have been in the Brier by 2016. And then you did end up making the Brier, but it took another 2 years after 2016. 2018, you finally made the Brier. And you had kind of one of the longest roads that a top skip has ever had to making the Brier. It took you 13 years from getting out of junior to making the Brier. And I was just curious, like, how did you keep going? Because I think a lot of people in your shoes would have hung them up and been like, you know what, God, I don't know. Like what kind of kept you going that entire 13-year stretch?
Well, there's one thing. I love the game, and I love curling, you know, no matter what. I have a huge passion. This has been, you know, it's been in my blood since I was a kid. I owe a lot of thanks to the continuation of there were some, after some finals that I was upset. In particular, there was one that I had lost. And my aunt, who is kind of a life coach, business coach, reached out to me and just said, when you're ready, I would love to talk. And we had a great conversation, and she really helped coach me the next couple of years, even worked with the whole team, a lot of focus on me and really being ready. I remember that final in 2018. When we were going out to play Glenn at the provincial final, and we had lost the A final and then the 1-2 game. So he's beaten us twice, and now we're going to the final. And I remember staying in the locker room. Everybody went out. I just kind of remember staying for an extra 10, 15 minutes in the locker room by myself before the game, and just really making sure that my mindset was not, here we go again. You know, this is we've been here, done that. So I owe a lot to her and part of that, and my family and friends and supporters that always just say, you know, we're proud of you, keep it going. And but you also have to remember too, we were still, you know, number six, and there was times that we were number four in the world, losing to number one in the world, which was Glenn. So you have to really make sure that you put it all in perspective too.
What was the final that particularly upset you? Like, what was it about that particular year or final that really set you off?
There was one we were just up a bunch and lost, and it just seemed like then to me it was like, you know, I was kind of the feeling of rock bottom and just not to be able to close the deal on that one.
My follow-up question was going to be like, what's advice that you maybe have for someone in a similar situation? You know, like maybe the guy who's interviewing you right now, who has lost his share of provincial finals as well. But like, you know, talking about your aunt, like what was sort of the one thing, maybe if you can distill it down, that she said that kind of helped sort of crack that egg for you? Because I know sometimes it can just be like one thing, and then all of a sudden you're looking at it from a different perspective. Is there one thing that you could kind of pin down that she really helped you with?
It was really paying attention to the routines and getting those really, you know, in place, and really having an understanding of your team as a whole, and what you're really pay attention to each other and not let each other drown if that's the case, or look into each other and see what's making them play their best. So I really focused on probably those three or four things that just made it so much easier when it got to that next final. We worked so hard at it those next couple of years that, you know, getting to that final, it, you know, kind of felt like this was going to happen to be all those processes were in place. I've got her number. She hasn't charged much. So good. You can afford it.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I got this Sportsnet podcast money now, so I can afford just about anything.
Raining.
You know it. I wanted to talk about your coming out story a little bit, if that's cool.
Of course.
So I was reading about it, you know, because, you know, preparing for this interview, and I think a lot has been talked about in this sort of realm. And you did a great interview with Greg Smith and Donovan Bennett on Sportsnet, which, if you're listening, you should go check it out if you haven't seen it, about you two playing each other, the first two openly gay skips to play each other at the Brier. So when you first came out, you know, there was an article written about you by Gregory Strong in the Canadian Press, and you had a really interesting quote that I wanted to ask you about. And I'll just read the quote here. You said, "If somebody asks, I just talk about it. And I know I should probably do more of these because it can help people, but I just look at it like, I haven't thought about going around broadcasting that I'm a gay person curling. This is my life. This is me. It's a part of life. It's what it is." And I do think it is interesting in sports right now, because there are so few openly gay people playing sports. It is a sort of situation where, when you come out, you become a sort of default ambassador, you know, that people want to, you know, talk to you about it and everything. And is that sort of weird? Like, is that a weird or a strange role? Like, just by virtue of coming out, now all of a sudden you're sort of in this position. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think it was it's a really fair thing to say at the time. We're looking 6 years ago, and in 6 years, I have a better understanding of the "it is what it is" probably statement that I made. And it was so new to me being in the spotlight with it, being asked by multiple journalists, broadcasters, sportscasters to talk about this. But now I think it's super important to be a role model ambassador for the community in sport. I think it's really important. I don't think, you know, if other athletes, whatever athlete, you know, decides to come out in the media or is outed or however it happens, I think it's a lot of pressure to put on somebody. I don't think that needs to be an expectation of anybody, that once that, you know, kind of happens, I think you choose if you want to kind of go that path. And I've chosen to talk about it openly. I encourage people to write me, to hop into my DMs if they need to talk at all or have questions about it, which it's great. I get questions from straight people and I get questions from gay people. So I think it's really good to open those doors. And you know, I'm giving all my personal experiences and what I'm seeing and the way I'm seeing the LGBT community shape in sport as well.
You know, I saw that quote and I was like, oh, I wonder if that has changed. So it's interesting, because that was going to be my next question. Like, you know, how do you think you've sort of grown into that role a bit? Because I do think, you know, and just knowing you too, I think it was maybe something that you felt a little bit odd about at first. And as you said, I do think you have, obviously, in the media and otherwise, have shown that you've sort of grown. What were some of the things that maybe helped you grow into that role a little bit more?
There's definitely some organizations and talking to other ambassadors and people that are more experienced has helped. I would say the more messages I get to talk to, you know, other people in the community that might be struggling, or it's new to them, or just even, you know, talking to people that don't quite have the understanding of why it's necessary to come out in the media, and to why can't you just be John the curler? Why do you have to be a, you know, John the gay curler? Well, yes, I'm still a curler, but I think it actually is very important, you know, with the way our world is. And yes, we're progressing, but there's lots of progress still to be made. I think it's important for myself. I feel it's important to be out in the media and open to discussions, and like a discussion today.
I was going to ask you sort of the last thing on this. What do you feel like in curling specifically? What's something that you see as the sport needing to improve when it comes to, you know, LGBTQ2S+ type stuff?
I think we need to continue to, you know, encourage leagues at different clubs. There's some great gay leagues across our country. And we have to remember with these leagues, you don't just play in them if you are gay. It's for, you know, LGBTQ members and allies. And that's such an important part of the community, is the people that are supportive. So it would be great to see that, you know, in more curling clubs, I think, especially in more rural areas. I'd love to see, you know, just more inclusiveness. It's not to say that they're not already inclusive. I just think to maybe promote that a little more and say, hey, this is a safe space for you to come and compete and play and have fun.
Yeah, because I mean, I think overall, especially compared to other sports, you know, curling's in a pretty decent spot when it comes to that stuff. But, you know, I think there's always room for improvement. And I think, you know, what you said is a great thing. I mean, obviously, I live in Vancouver, the home of the Pacific Rim League, which is, you know, a very well-known and long-established gay league. And yeah, like you said, I think the allies component of it is key, too. I think a lot of people don't realize it's not some sort of, you know, like closed situation where, you know, oh, well, that's, you know, queer people play in that league, so I can't, you know, or whatever. I think that's an important point.
It's a huge point to make. And I think, yeah, having that support and think is just so, so important.
Before we get into this year, I always like to do a little fun mid-episode segment called Dirty Laundry, where I, you know, I ask some people about, you know, for some dirt on you. You're a guy that's maybe not easy to track dirt down on, but I got sent a photo. And it's not as your eyes went wide. It's not as incriminating as it sounds. But this was a photo that was posted to Don McEwen's Instagram. Do yourself a favor. Head on over to Don McEwen's Instagram. It's a series of two photos. But the second one in particular, you're down on one knee. Don is sitting on your knee and you are handing her a white rose. John Epping, can you tell me exactly what's going on here?
I guess I thought that I was going to be married to a woman. Just psych. Whoops. You know, or maybe it was the first date, or I was asking her a date. I'm not sure, but I do remember that. That was that was in Calgary at a spiel they used to have, and her team, she was playing with Jen Hanna, and I was actually playing with Sebastian Robillard.
Oh, my old teammate.
We played together in juniors and we were out at a spiel together and yeah, they had this little photo session thing and yeah, Don and I put on a performance. So
very funny time capsule for multiple reasons, but yeah, it was a great look. And honestly, a little bit of an underrated, like you go down on one knee and the girl sits on your knee. I'm not going to tell you how to live your life, but if you were to ever recreate the picture with Tom,
you could, okay. Oh, I thought you said recreate the picture with Don. See if Donner and I could do that after 22 years.
That knee's got a lot more slides in it now.
It's like, it's okay, Mike. You don't have to worry.
Yeah. I heard you were taking pictures of the John Epping. Yeah, I was. All right, now let's get into this last year. Obviously, it's been a crazy sort of last 365 days for curlers. And I want to talk to you a little bit about your team's dissolution at the end of last year, you know, because I think when you came together with Ryan Fry a year into last year's quad, a lot was made about how close you two are, that, you know, you two are great friends and you had wanted to curl with each other for a long time and you're finally getting the opportunity to play together. And I think it's fair to say that it probably didn't work out exactly the way that you guys were hoping. You know, you had a couple of nice wins, but it, you know, I feel like it didn't quite, you know, especially last year, felt like, you know, everybody kind of knew their team's probably done. What do you think in particular maybe didn't quite work as well with the pairing of you two?
That's a really good question. I actually thought things went quite well with him. I mean, I'd like to say the pandemic was really tough on our team. You have to remember, right before everything happened, we were number one in the world. You know, we had won the Canada Cup, had won three spiels in the fall, you know, had a pretty decent run at the Brier. We lost the tiebreaker game to Jacobs at the hometown Brier. So, you know, it was going then, of course, we didn't play for a while. I don't know what kind of went wrong there. It's a really, really great question. It just seemed like it was tough for us as a team, I would say as a foursome, to win games. And I know Mike and Ryan have a great relationship and had developed quite a close relationship over the course of the last couple of years during COVID. So it wasn't surprising to me that they decided to go and play together. But overall, I was pretty happy with, I would say, our run for the couple of years. The trials, we even actually kind of got it going. You know, I'd love a couple of shots back, you know, 2-3 shots back. And I think that trials is very different for us, and we're maybe into the playoffs. So, I mean, you know, we showed some life there, and I really don't know why maybe it didn't work out, you know, at the end, and why we didn't have more, let's say, consistent success over the last year and a half.
Right. And so you're saying that it was sort of Ryan's decision to leave, like you would have played with him again?
Yeah, I think we would have talked about what the future would have looked like. But I know Ryan had had already made up his mind before we talked as a team that that he was going to go and play with Mike, and which wasn't shocking. I mean, I had a list and options and things, what some squads could look like if things didn't work out, and even ones that involved included in Ryan and ones that that didn't. And but no, it wasn't a total surprise that he had left. And it's not also to say that we would have stayed together if he didn't end up going with Mike.
Right. Now tell me a little bit about how this year's team came together, because I think as a casual observer of the game, people might see it as a bit of a step back in just in the sense that, you know, you're playing with two Olympians in Brent and Ryan, and, you know, you're moving Matt up from second to third, and not that Matt doesn't have experience at third, but I think people might have seen that lineup and thought, oh, this is interesting. I might have thought John maybe would have hooked up with some more high profile names, for lack of a better word. But obviously you've had a great year. So what was sort of the impetus for that kind of, you know, forming that lineup? What made you sort of go in that direction and perhaps not pursue maybe a more, I guess, high profile, you know, match, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, obviously, I had two unbelievably decorated curlers on my team, and then the experience in Langer and what he brings to the game. But I think there was something to be said about the hunger and the want to have even greater success that hadn't been had before, and that's something that, you know, you see in somebody like you know, Scott Chadwick, who's been a steady player in Ontario for a long time, has had a good run, went to the Brier with McDonald, and then obviously to the trials last year with Horgan. So somebody who, you know, has had a taste for a couple of big events. But I thought it was a great opportunity to have him on, obviously him also being 6'3" and you know,
built like a fridge,
250 pounds is not going to hurt you either.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, with Pat, I've played with Pat before, and, you know, I joke our second marriage we're going into again, and this is it. You know, and I know his work ethic and what he's capable of, and leaving that team the first time wasn't anything to do with shot making. It was just for an opportunity to play with the experience and exposure that I had. So that was easy. And then Matt going back to playing third is an easy fit for me. He was my third for 4 or 5 years. He's what I'm comfortable with and I know, and the relationship is great. And it's felt super easy this year. It's kind of a very, very comfort thing for me when I'm out there and having Pat again sweeping my rocks, and somebody who's swept my rocks for 4 years. So that's, you know, obviously great. And I think it's a team that still have more that we want to win and accomplish that hasn't been done. So I think that's, you know, an exciting part, a part for me.
Nice. Yeah. I want to know, did you get any spicy offers to play third for anyone?
There were some offers out there. There was not really any to play third, I would say. There was some discussions. It was, but yeah, there was some,
okay.
There were some discussions had, but this one was pretty quick for me, and was almost a couple of days after we had, you know, on our other team had disbanded, that this was ready to go.
Fair enough. I wasn't sure. I was just like, you know, maybe. Obviously, you're still a very top level skip.
Well, thank you.
But this off season, I felt like everything was on the table. So I wasn't sure if someone was ringing you up being like, you know, you could make a pretty good third.
Totally. Thank you. Yeah, no, I know nothing against playing third at all. I'd be into that with the right situation, and no, nothing like that.
All right. Now, I want to ask you, one of the popular narratives in the game is, you know, people talk about scheduling. And we see it a lot, particularly with Krista McCarville. We see it the other way, where oftentimes we hear, oh, a certain team doesn't play enough. You know, whether it's Krista McCarville or whether it's some of the other teams on the men's or the ladies' side where, you know, they're playing their 5 to 7 events a year, but, you know, and then they're good. We see them at the Scotties and we, you know, or the Brier and we go, geez, they're pretty good. You know, why don't they play more? One thing we don't talk about, though, is they're playing too much? And if that exists, you're probably on the poster for that, because, I mean, your schedule, for people who don't know, this year has been insane. I mean, I'm interviewing you here on January 6th, and you've played 14 events this year already. Has there ever been a time where you felt like this is too much? Like, you play more than anybody. First of all, what's your reasoning for wanting to play so much? And do you think that it's affected your game in a positive or negative way?
Well, the whole idea was not to play this much, but when you have mixed doubles and you have men's, that's what happened, right? Those 14 events were, I think, five mixed doubles and the nine men's events. That was not what we were planning on, but we committed as the doubles. We want to commit to that slam series or mixed doubles series. I should say super series. We wanted to commit to that Jay and Wayne had put together and support their events. You know, and for Lisa and I too, we have to play too, because we're also part of the national team and it's important for us to make sure that we are playing those events. And then with the men's team, that's the luxury. I should say it's not a luxury, but when you're on the cusp of the rankings for the Grand Slams, and we were sitting on that 15th, 16th hovering. And so we had to play a couple extra events to try and get into those Grand Slam events, which, you know, as you know, the exposure, and it's important when you have your partners that support your team and you need to make sure that you can be at as many of those events as possible. And they just make you better. I mean, look at what's happening in the world. We're seeing it right now that those events are tough and it's great to really play. If we were guaranteed to be inside that a little more in the slams, we definitely wouldn't play.
You'd like to play less.
Much, much less. And doubles, from what I'm hearing, is next year things will be spread out a little more, which then takes it to a very different schedule. But I went on a 10 in a row run at one point.
Yes.
I would like to say it probably hurt me at the last mixed doubles event, but it actually didn't hurt me during the course of my 10 in a row. We qualified actually in every event we played in and, you know, lost a couple of semis. I mean, the one slam we didn't qualify, but we're right in the mix in the round robin. So, but I was really mindful of my energy levels and rest, you know, during those events. But I overplayed by far.
So in your mind, like, what's an ideal? Where would you be at if you had your druthers? Like,
I would,
8 or 9 combined events?
Yeah, exactly. Play, you know, 6 men's and then you play maybe 3 doubles before Christmas would be ideal. This was just an odd year.
Now, speaking of your mixed doubles team, you play with Lisa Weigel, as you said, and I've been begging you to for years. You got to call the team Weeping. What are we doing here? Why are we not? I'm mad. I tell both of you and you just won't do it. And to me, it's a missed opportunity. You could have a logo with like someone's crying and it's like curling rocks or the tears. Like, I think we're dropping the ball here, John.
I get it. That's a $1 million idea right there.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You could, I mean, think of all the eye drop Visine. Visine would be ready to sponsor you guys in a hot minute.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? You make it happen. You do all the, you be our branding agent and you'll
here
get a nice,
go.
You'll get a nice cut. We'll give you a nice cut. Send the contract over.
John, we're going to finish the show with a segment that I like to call extremely difficult own career trivia. This is where I ask you questions about your own curling career, moments that you specifically were a part of. There are going to be 5 total points available. So far, Mark Kennedy is the high man at 3. We'll see how well you fare. Question number 1. You went to the Canadian Juniors in 2004, where you just missed the playoffs going 8-4, and the 3 teams that made the playoffs all went 9-3. Of those 3 teams that went 9-3, you beat one of them in the round robin. Which of those 3 did you beat in the round robin?
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland is right. Do you remember who skipped?
Blanford.
Matt Blanford. There you go. Okay, one for one. Very good, John.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. Question number two. You played in the Everest Spiel in 2017, the famous, the mixer, you know, where everybody was playing with different people, and you narrowly lost the final to Brad Gugew. You beat Kevin Cooey in the semifinal, who had your teammate Pat on his team. Which two women rounded out that four-person squad?
Emma and Dawn.
Wow. Okay, John, I'm impressed.
Thank you.
I thought that was a particularly tricky one, and you're on it like right away. That's very good.
My curling memory is here. Okay.
Your curling memory is here. All right.
You should see how quickly I'm booing over here. It's impressive. I'm kidding.
That would be, if you Googled it that quickly, that would be unbelievable. And you brought this up apropos of nothing, but I did have a question about it, so it's perfect. In those 2018 Ontario Provincials where you won and went to the Brier for the first time, you beat Glenn Howard in the final 5-1. However, as you noted already, he did beat you in both the A final and the 1-2 game. By how many combined points did he beat you in those two games?
Gosh, are you kidding me? He probably beat me by a combined 8.
So close, John. 9 points. 10-6 in the A final and 8-3 in the 1-2 game.
Oh, that's close.
But then you took him down 5-1 after six blank ends in the final.
That was wild.
What happened?
Yeah, remember that? That was crazy. Yeah, the ice got, so they, I don't know what they did. The ice got to, and I'm not exaggerating, 17 to 17 and a half hog to hog.
Whoa.
We couldn't keep it. So what happens is your leads would throw the guards in the house. You'd throw a draw for two through the ring. Oh, it was crazy. I don't know if they overclipped or nipped or what, but it was nuts.
You just have to like fall out of the hack. All right. Last question. In the 2018 Golden Wrench Classic in Tempe, Arizona, you finished the round robin at 3-1, and you had to play a tiebreaker to make it into the playoffs, which you won. Who did you beat in the tiebreaker?
Are you kidding me? Who did I beat in the tiebreaker? I think we lost to Laycock in the next game in the quarters. Who did we lose to?
That's right. You did lose to Laycock. Yeah.
Who did we beat? It was an American team, I think. Oh, I even know what they look like. I got nothing.
It was me, John. It was me.
It was you?
It was Team Dean Jonice.
Oh,
my goodness.
No.
Wow. My heart's broken. Wow. My heart is broken. He doesn't even remember.
That's fair. Yeah.
Well, it clearly had more of an impact on me than it did on you because I lost. Because I lost. When you lose, you tend to remember it a little bit more than when you win.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, because you guys kicked our ass in the round robin, but then we beat Laycock. It was so weird. I was looking at the draw last night. This is a classic draw. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Me, you, and Laycock tied at 3-1 in the round robin. It was a 6-team playoff. By virtue of Laycock's draw, they were in the semifinals and we were in the tiebreaker.
Tiebreaker. Wow. That's probably not.
No,
right.
Probably not.
That's for another day.
So you actually won the quarterfinals and then you lost the semis to Laycock. So
to Laycock. Yeah. Right. I do. Okay.
Crazy times. That. Crazy times. But hey, at least we were in Arizona.
Oh, great place to play.
Great place to play. Yeah, absolutely. John, this was a true treat, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for doing it. Before we go, I'd like to give you a chance to plug your sponsors. So have at it.
Team Epping would like to thank Grounded Engineering, as you can see my hat, Shipton's Heating and Cooling, Epic Ale, Chadwick Farms, Custom Garage Solutions, Balance Plus, Runback, and of course, the Leaside Curling Club.
There you go. Beautiful. Thank you so much, John. Take care and best of luck with the rest of the season.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you, John.
So there you have it, John Epping. What a great talk. I always love talking to John. Great guy, great ambassador for the game in many different ways, honestly, and one of the busiest guys on tour. It was exciting to talk to him about that. It was a bit of a a bit of a learning experience for all of us. Off the top of this episode, we hopped into the Way Inside, Way Back Machine. We looked at some recent history. Now, I'm 37 years old. I'm maybe not as good at some of the past history of curling. And so I thought, who better am I to call to learn about something in curling's past than my very own Poppy Warren, Warren Hansen? I said, Warren, I got to learn something about the game because I grew up in an era where we already had the free guard zone. The Hammer XL was dominating the broom landscape, the 10-inch brownie brush. And Warren said, John, let me tell you a story about how we used to sweep the ice. And then 7 minutes later, he was done talking. And here is the story. This is my Poppy Warren with the history of the corn broom.
Why can I never find what I'm looking for? Here we go.
Yeah, okay. Let's go.
Okay. We look through history with curling, and certainly the game developed on the ponds and lochs of Scotland.
Oh my God, he's starting with ponds and lochs?
There was necessity for the path in front of the stone to be clean, so they brought out what would be a later example. It was a corn broom, a broom made from broom corn of some substance that was used to clear the path in front of the rock because, of course, there was snow happening many times and other things that could obstruct. So that's kind of where the whole thing originated. Interesting enough, Scotland turned to brushes, not sure exactly when or why. We don't know that history, but certainly the corn broom and how it evolved in Canada, we know a fair amount about. So
thank God.
Certainly as the sport came into Canada, people were using brooms that were made of various things, I would imagine, initially, but ultimately into the 30s, 40s, these brooms were all made of broom corn, which actually came for the most part from southern U.S. and Mexico. The brooms used by the players up until the mid-50s pretty much resembled the same kind of broom that you'd use to clean your house with, and there was no weight to the end of the broom at all, so virtually the most thing they could do was, again, clear the path, which still in those days, there was a lot of frost and different things that they could very much assist in helping things be better. But in 1953...
I was negative 32.
A gentleman in Montreal by the name of Fern Marcisseau decided he wanted to get into the curling broom business, and he developed a new concept that created a lot of excitement for the sport over the next 20, 30-year period. And what he did was the traditional corn brooms being used that were wide broke very easily because of how they were attached to the band at the top of the broom. Hard to explain.
I mean, you're going to try, though, aren't you? You're going to try to explain it, Warren.
He cut off a lot of the outside of the broom about 6 inches from the bottom. So the broom actually had a skirt on it. And the actually broom part of the broom doing the sweeping was this, was the inner part, not the outer part. And so this cut down the breakage to some degree. But what he also did, the key thing here was he invented something referred to as the floating string.
The floating string. That sounds cool, actually.
And he took and he attached a string bound through the bottom of the broom about probably 6 inches, 8 inches from the bottom of the broom. And it was attached on the outside by another string that went inside the broom up to the handle. So this was the moving string. This bottom string bounding the broom together, it actually moved. But what it did was it concentrated the straw in towards the center of the broom and give the broom actually by doing this more of a weight on the tip.
And so more of a weight on the tip.
Tighter, it was a little bit heavier on the end. And so you could hit the ice with more force, which certainly was determined by that time to be effective. You had to be able to hit the ice with a straw, the broom, fairly hard.
Okay, this is cool, actually. I like this. This is good.
The whole idea was further enhanced by Curlmaster when they started making these brooms back in the early 60s. They took the big straws that were at the top large and tapered down to the end. They took a number of those in the center of the broom and they inverted them. Ooh. So the big straw came to the bottom and it now went tapered up to the top. And so it further increased the weight of this broom, the broom itself at the end, so you could increase the force. And of course, you now started to make some noise with the thing as well, which didn't exist before. The problem with these inverted straws, however, was they were big and pulpy, and they shattered very easily. So you ended up getting a lot of broom pulp on the ice surface as a result of these inverted straw brooms. And there was a point in time where some curling clubs almost were threatening, and I think did some cases banned them. The trademark that these brooms were made under was Curlmaster was the originator, and the Blackjack.
The Blackjack. See, now that is sick. If there was a broom on the market right now named the Blackjack, that's the one I'd be using.
And their main competitor, Midwestern Broom, had another one that was equally as popular called the Rockmaster.
The Rockmaster sounds like what a rush hour DJ would call himself.
And during the early 60s, those were the two most popular brooms. But during that same period of time, Curlmaster started out with another idea by further increasing the weight at the end of the broom and the quickness, the recoil action of the broom. They put a leatherette insert down through the center of the broom as well and cut it off about an inch from the tip.
How does he know all of this? I'm going to have to call Warren personally and ask him how he could. Like, this is off the top of his head. How does he know all this stuff?
Now, through all this, Fern Marchichaud ended up being connected with Curlmaster. And there was a patent on this floating string.
Ooh. I know patent stuff can get a little bit hectic.
And he owned the patent, of course. Through Curlmaster, they ended up with the rights to it. So there were three main broom companies, Midwestern, Curlmaster, and Fergal. Although Curlmaster owned the patent, the other two companies continued to make brooms with the skirt and the key thing that was the patent, the floating string, through this entire period of time. And the thing that started to change everything was in 1975, the young team of Paul Gausel won the Canadian Juniors.
Paul Gausel, I remember him, ordered a pizza to a game one time when his opposition was playing too slow.
Who went into the men's side of things and started to defeat everybody. They were using brushes. They weren't using brooms. By the time we hit 1980, the corn brooms had pretty much disappeared. Rick Folk was the last team to win the Brier with a corn broom in 1980. And by 1985, the corn brooms had pretty much failed to exist. I was in the corn broom business. I worked with Midwestern Broom. The interesting thing about the whole floating string and the patent that Marchessault won, there was a point in time when Curlmaster did sue the other two companies. The other two companies knew it was coming. They had been reserving 25 to 50 cents a broom for years because they knew that they were going to have to end up paying this royalty. And in the end, Curlmaster did win the royalty contest, and the other two companies had to pay them. But as all that was happening, the corn brooms pretty much faded into oblivion, and by the mid to the late 80s, they virtually no longer existed. They were replaced by brushes as a result of Paul Gausel.
Poppy Warren, what a lesson! I didn't know almost any of that. I feel knowledgeable. I feel smart. That's probably not going to happen too often on Way Inside. Thank you so much to Warren Hansen for the history lesson on the corn broom. I know we often do a question of the week here at the end of the show, but this week we thought we'd change things up a bit. Thanks again to Warren for that. Thank you to John Epping for sitting down with me for a great interview. Thanks to Amal and Mike. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Cullen on Curling. Come on over. I'm tweeting a lot of dumb things, just like I say a lot of dumb things on this show. And hopefully you'll be back with us in 2 weeks for another episode of Way Inside. I've been John Cullen. Remember, if you're going to be inside, be way inside.